Start today with the characteristic of non-conceptual wisdom. Full understanding of that involves understanding the five forms of pseudo non-conceptuality that are to be surrendered, or given up, and these are unconducive or unfavorable factors. They do not contribute to realizing non-conceptual wisdom. And can we say they are not non-conceptual wisdom? And if one thinks they are, then one will be. It will work against oneself. It will act as an unfavorable factor or an adverse condition or something that will block you or be a hindrance on the path. So it's important to know what these five mistaken ways of understanding wisdom might be. So to read through the commentary first, to get the main picture of it, and then we can go back and hear Ricci's explanation. Full understanding regarding the characteristic of non-conceptual original wisdom is rendered accessible through a process of elimination applied to the five instances of pseudo-non-conceptuality, which are not conducive to genuine wisdom. And these five factors are a lack of the process of thought, correct transcendence, tranquilization, things in their composition, and predetermination. The exclusion of these five is the concrete characteristic of non-conceptual wisdom. The reason for proceeding in this way, that is to say, through a process of elimination, eliminating the five things that are not non-conceptual wisdom, the reason why we go about it in this strange way is that non-conceptual original wisdom does not see any image at all which could function as a focal object. We had in the emptiness group that at the point when there are no things and no non-things in relation to an intellectual mind or a thinking mind, then there is no image. And we have the same sort of a statement here that non-conceptual wisdom does not see an image which could function as a focal object. That is to say, it does not involve the perceptual process at all. Nevertheless, it sees the suchness of all phenomena in a manner which could be likened to the way forms are so-called seen by a person blind from birth. Since it cannot be described in an obvious and affirmative fashion for those whose vision is limited to this shore, its essence is defined in terms of what it is not, namely, it is not conceptual in any sense. Nevertheless, it unerringly realizes pure being, that reality which does not function as a focal referent, and in relation to which no theoretical conclusions are applicable, in a manner not involving the perceptual process at all, as is consistent with pure being. So that's quite a difficult paragraph. We'll take it now a bit slow. So why do we go about looking at non-conceptual wisdom in terms of what it is not? And we do that because non-conceptual wisdom itself does not see any sort of an image at all which can function as a focal referent. There is no zimpa involved at all. No zimpa, there is no perception. No perceptual process involving something that can be perceived and a perceiver of it. And nevertheless, even though it does not see in this dualistic way, and this will maybe answer many of the questions that the people from the emptiness class have had, exactly as to what is going on in the realization of emptiness. There is no dualistic perception involved. Nevertheless, it, that is to say, this non-conceptual wisdom, sees the suchness of all phenomena. So if there's no subject-object dualism, then how can a wisdom be seeing an object, namely the suchness of all phenomena? So in order to give some idea of that, this example is used, like a person who is born from, in the same way that a person who is born from birth, who is blind from birth, maybe I better drink some of this. That a person blind from birth would see forms. And Rinpoche said that someone who was blind from birth would have great difficulty relating to forms because it's never seen any. It would be different if it was a person who had gone blind later and started out being able to see and then later went blind. They would still have some idea of how things look. They would have a dunchi, dunchi is called general idea, or the abstract idea. They would be able to form a general picture of that object in their mind. But a person who has never seen forms at all would have difficulty in forming any picture of how the thing would look. And this is the way that, this is the sort of way that non-conceptual wisdom sees the suchness of all phenomena. There is no dunchi involved. There's no abstract idea of it. There's no picture being raised before the mind to which the non-conceptual wisdom is relating as an object. So, so then the text goes on to talk about from the perspective of those who see this shore. And that's a literal translation, this shore, this side. And this side means those who see the appearances of this life, meaning ordinary beings who, well, what do we see? We see form, sound, smell, taste, touch. If somebody moves their hand, we can see that. But we don't see pure realms, for example. We don't see the bodies of Yidam deities. We don't see mandalas. We don't see pure appearances. We can sort of see them in an indirect way through deduction. A jepak way of seeing. An indirect way of seeing them through deduction. But we don't see them directly. So from the perspective of people like us who only see this side of things and not pure appearances, then it is not possible to present non-conceptual wisdom, you know, to show it, to demonstrate it in a positive way. You know, directly saying it is this and this and this. So what the way that it is done then is that one shows what it is not. And the reason why one cannot say what it is that the essence of it is not something that can be thought in any way at all. So we're having the same problem with the prasangika emptiness meditation. We're trying to think that emptiness, we're trying to get some idea of it, some thought we can apply to it. And there are no thoughts that apply to that essence. It cannot be thought. It is nam tok le depa, transcends thought. In the commentary is 38, line 2 towards the end. Chuni ta kang duong miksu mepe den manorwa to. So this section says, this phrase, it says, even though it, that is to say the non-conceptual wisdom, is not conceptual in any sense, nevertheless it, without any mistakes, realizes pure being, that reality which does not function as a focal referent, and in relation to which no theoretical conclusions are applicable. So that is to say that pure being is not something that can appear in the same sort of a way than the form of a flower could appear to us. It cannot function as a focal referent, appearing in a dualistic fashion. And therefore, one cannot relate any theoretical conclusions to it. You know, you can't, by way of thinking, deduce that it must be like this and like this, and then apply that to pure being and have it cover the case fully. It will never be able to define that ultimate reality fully. And in fact, it will not be applicable. So, then, how does non-conceptual wisdom perceive, in a manner not involving the perceptual process at all, as is consistent with pure being? There is some sort of a way of experiencing it going on. Even though it's not a dualistic way of perceiving it, because it's not an appearance, nevertheless, it's also not just emptiness. It's not a literal sort of emptiness where there is just nothing. And therefore it can be perceived, but not perceived in the sense of dualistic perception. And that's that part of it, we have to get clear. Then what exactly it is, that will maybe become more clear as we go along. But at this point, we're only saying what it is not. That it is a way of, and it's called an unmistaken realization of that meaning, that reality, which in no way functions as a focal referent, and to which no extremes or theoretical conclusions apply. So you can never see it, you can neither see it as a sensory impression nor think it in an intellectual way.
I didn't quite get the example with the blind. I mean, somebody who's blind perceives form
by touching
him.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the point, the way that Rinpoche explained it was in this term, dunchi. Dunchi means the general idea, the general picture of the form. In other words, an abstract idea, right? And an abstract idea would be something conceived by the rational mind, right? And the person blind from birth would have difficulties forming an abstract idea or general picture of a form in his mind because he's never seen one. And in the same way, non-conceptual wisdom perceives, or let's not use that word, realizes a pure being in a way that does not involve a dunchi. There is no abstract idea formed about that ultimate nature.
Mm-hmm.
So it is some sort of a direct perception,
mm-hmm.
in the same way that a person blind from birth would, his way of relating to forms would be directly by touching them. Wouldn't have a general picture about it.
But doesn't a realized person have a memory about the time when it was not realized, when he had this kind of... I mean, is it totally away?
Well, it's at this point we're talking about the realization of pure being itself, which in the Sutrayana text is reserved for the state of meditative equipoise. And during the state of meditative equipoise of a realized bodhisattva, there are no appearances. It is a non-conceptual resting within pure being. So there is no thought of pure being being formed to which the bodhisattva is relating. And there's, of course, no direct appearance of that as a form or sound or as anything else. So those type of perceptual experiences only come up in the post-meditative state. And then, as we were talking about before, they are all experienced in the same sort of way that forms in a dream would be experienced if you know you're dreaming. So those forms in your dream would be some sort of a memory. They would be, you know,
yeah.
some sort of a habitual tendency appearing in that form.
Mm.
So in that sense, the bodhisattva would also have a sort of, some sort of leftovers
yeah.
from these bhakchakra, which would then take these different shapes, but there would be no tendency to think of them in terms of being truly existent. Tini, not so... Sini. Sini Sama Song. Nga la lep ma song. Dangpo chi chi tensu yore. Chi tensu di karikabore.
What is it?
A spider.
A spider.
So, is that part clear? Well, I don't think we're going to be able to say anything more about it than I can repeat it.
And it only refers, it doesn't refer to the state of a Buddha as well?
Well, we're talking about the transformation, right? This whole section is still under that what's called the basis for the transformation. You know, if you recall, there were 6 points under that, and this is the sixth one, full understanding. And then under full understanding, this is one of the 4 points.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still talking about what forms the support, or the basis, for developing non-conceptual wisdom. The basis for non-conceptual wisdom at this point is understanding its characteristic from the point of view of what it is not.
Mm-hmm.
So... we can definitely say that non-conceptual wisdom does not perceive pure being in any sort of perceptual way involving a duality of perceived and perceiver. And also, It's not that nothing at all is being experienced. It's not just a complete, total blank. So what is it that is going on? That is what we have to find out by trying to think our way through what it is not. And the text goes on to say, the cases not conveying what is intended in this text by the term non-conceptual include a total absence of consciousness, states of block consciousness, and so on, as further elaborated below. So there are various ways that the mind could be non-conceptual. It could, for example, be in a state of total absence of consciousness, as in deep sleep. So then one could think, well, just going to sleep then would be non-conceptual wisdom. So it's very easy. We don't have to do a lot of studying. We don't have to make a big effort. We can just go to sleep, and then it would be non-conceptual wisdom. This is not the case. A mere lack of the process of thought, wherein the elaborations associated with worldly conventions are conceptualized by associating names and their reference, is not what is meant by non-conceptual, just as there is no such conceptuality in the mindstream of a newly born child, or in that of a calf, and so on, without this being what is implied by non-conceptual here. So first let me explain this, the process of thought, that is this term that is used here. And what one has to understand that in this process, there the name of a thing is being mixed together with the object to which that name refers. So conceptually, one is taking the name and its referent as one. One perceives the two as one. And that sort of perception is called the process of thought. Or it's also called precisely associating names and their reference. Associating them means one mixes them together. And so that's the way we're defining conceptualization in an ordinary sense. And if that sort of conceptualization merely stops, that is not non-conceptual wisdom. For example, there is no that sort of a conceptual process is not going on in the mind of a newly born child. For example, Rinpoche said, the newly born child doesn't know his mother's name. You know, he likes his mother, but he doesn't know her name. That would be, knowing her name is something that comes later. The newly born child makes some sounds. Sounds like, aham. natural sounds which just come out without any effort or without having to think about it. But those sounds are not being associated with some referent for the sound. Sound and referent are not being mixed together, so that sort of conceptual process is missing. And the same is true of a calf, a newly born calf, you know, the young of a cow. And Rinpoche said it could be either, this is true either whether it's a boy child or a female child. And it could even be a hermaphrodite child. Mm-hmm. Hermaphrodite is neither male or female, it's both. Or neither. Well, can it be neither? Well, he must have something in front. Anyway. But in any case, whether it's male, female, or both, or neither, there wouldn't be this process of conceptualization in this sense of mixing names and reference, nor would there be that in the mind of a calf. And then in Tibetan, this word is beu, right? And one has various names for the young of different types of animals, whether it's the young of goats or dogs or horses. There are different names for that in Tibetan. For cats? I don't know, did you say? For What?
You said the word.
For cows? Bale. 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 So, then one could argue, so let's take this from commentary. Even though the potential for blending term and referent is present in the mind stream of a child, a newly born is not involved in such a process of associative perception and does not know how to engage in conceptual examination and analysis. Hence, the example is valid for the case in point. So to say that there is a potential for mixing form and mixing name and referent means that at some point the child will be able to do that, but is not doing it at the moment. There is no actual process of that going on, even though the potential is there. So that's the first case of a non-conceptual state, which you cannot call non-conceptual wisdom. The next one is what is called correct transcendence. And this refers to the levels from the second bodhisattva level, from the stage just after the second bodhisattva level, and then from there up. And the commentary on it says, mere correct transcendence of examination and analysis, characterized respectively as rough and fine, such as the state of consciousness associated with the second level of meditative concentration and upwards, would not be non-conceptual original wisdom either. So the way that Rinpoche explained today, the second level would not be included in this, actually. It would be from the level after the second and upwards. So it means from the third, even though it says from the second. So the point here is there is this process of examination and analysis, and they're in the Tibetan they refer to two different things. The English words are more or less completely equivalent. There's not a real distinction between them. But in Tibetan, the first word, tokpa, is a slightly rougher level. And the second word, cho, an analysis, is a finer level of it, more subtle level. And both of these are conceptual processes. Examination and analysis are ways of relating to objects which have a conceptual character.
What is the difference between like Sherab and Yeshe?
No, it's not like that. It's connected with the ordinary process of perception, where the consciousness is examining and analyzing the object which it is perceiving. And Rinpoche didn't go into the details of that in his explanation, and that's a point that belongs to the Abhidharma. It's quite difficult to really get the details of it. One has to study the skandhas in the Abhidharma section to really get it clear. It's not the sort of subject we can just sort of say it's like that, and it's finished. Would require quite a bit of thought and research to get really clear about it. So let's just take it in general that it's the rougher and the finer way that the consciousnesses examine and analyze their objects, which is not present from the third bodhisattva, not bodhisattva, the third samten onwards.
The practice is called the Dagan Chan.
I don't know the Sanskrit very well. Shenpa knows the Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm.
Not those terms.
Do you think those terms are what called the Dagan Chan?
Because I understood that non-conceptual wisdom is the first level of bodhisattva.
No, we're not talking about bodhisattvas here at all.
It is about the samadhi concentration of leading to God realization.
Yes, yes.
So it was mistaken because I understood that you said that it's about bhumis.
Yes.
No.
So,
did I say bhumis?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh.
It was for me quite strange.
It's not bhumis now.
Yeah.
Huh?
You
corrected
yourself.
I corrected myself. Okay. You didn't pick up the correction.
Yeah.
You'll hear it on your tape.
So it's a third samtin level.
Yeah, so what happens on the samtin levels? A samtin level means these meditative concentrations that belong to the samsaric god realms. There were distinguishes between form gods and formless gods, right? And on the four levels of concentration, as they're called, or as they're sometimes translated, and actually, Rinpoche didn't explain all this. You're getting an extra reward for your diligence. On the first level of samten, there are four factors. There's tokchu ga de, what's it called? Examination, analysis, joy, and happiness, or however you want to translate de, bliss, or whatever. And then on the second level of samten, there is only tok and chu, isn't it? Wait a minute.
No,
it's tokchu and ga. You have three of them, right? And then on the third level, it's only, no, sorry. How's this going?
Because when they drop one by one.
Yeah. Yeah, so on the second level you have Chu, Ga, and De, apparently. That's not the way I remember it, actually. The way I remember it is on the first you have all four. On the second you only have Ga and De. On the third you have De, and on the fourth you don't have any of them.
Sometimes they say there are five levels.
Right?
Sometimes they say there are five levels, some schools have
five
levels. Yes. Drop one by
one. Yes.
But in that, if you get four, the two drop together, those two.
Yeah, this is...
Then it is with the second afterwards.
This is why what Rinpoche said today fits with the five-level explanation, and the way I've translated it fits with the four-level explanation.
Is it a hierarchy, these four or five?
It's a hierarchy in the sense that it gets more and more subtle as you go up. Finer and finer levels of consciousness.
The one without anything is the finest one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's still all in a completely relative sense. It's
yeah.
still relative consciousness getting finer and finer.
Mm-hmm.
The main point of it here is, and let's take the four-level explanation, so then it fits with the translation, that from the second level and upwards, there's no conceptual process as such. Described as being examination and analysis. Nevertheless, even though there is this type of non-conceptuality, you can't call this non-conceptual original wisdom. Why not? Because even though the state of mind achieved there is non-conceptual, it is not realizing the ultimate nature. It does not realize pure being, so you can't call it non-conceptual wisdom. Then the next point is called tranquilization, which means tranquilization of concepts, as in the case of deep sleep, loss of consciousness, inebriation, and the state of repose in the equilibrium of cessation. So obviously in deep sleep there are no perceptions in an ordinary sense. The sixfold collection of consciousness is said to dissolve into the all-base consciousness. And that includes all five sensory as well as the rational thinking mind. So within deep sleep there is no concept. But that obviously is not non-conceptual wisdom because in deep sleep one is not realizing pure being, one is not realizing the nature of mind. If one were, then one would be realized being when one woke up again. And even already in the dream, right? Already when the dream came out of the deep sleep, you would immediately recognize that it was a dream, and it wouldn't see all the appearances in the dream as being real. So deep sleep is not non-conceptual wisdom. The same goes for, loss of consciousness. That can mean fainting or being tranquilized for an operation or anything like that. Loss of consciousness, passing out, fainting. The same goes for inebriation. You know, you can get so drunk on alcohol that you get into a non-conceptual state.
Really?
And then,
yeah, well, people do things like somebody I know came into his house and slept on top of the washing machine. You know, I thought it was his bed. Had no concept at all. He just slept on the washing machine. And you probably know many examples of people doing weird things when they're so drunk that they don't know what they're doing. The concepts are not being associated with the objects, right? But that's obviously not a realization of pure being. Well, you might get some. You can get a glimpse of something, but you probably forgot it the next day. Yeah, and then the last one is called the state of repose in the equilibrium of cessation. And in general, this is a term applying again to the God realms within the samsaric cycle. And the term equilibrium means a state of evenness in which concepts are not being applied in the usual way. So there is a type of cessation of concepts, but this is not non-conceptual wisdom. Why? Because even though there is a blockage or a cessation of the thinking process, there is still no realization of pure being. If one were talking about the type of state of equilibrium of a bodhisattva, of a realized bodhisattva, then there would also be this meditative state or this state of equilibrium in which everything would be, all appearances would be perceived as equal without the ordinary concepts applying in the way that they do for a non-realized being. So the realized bodhisattva would have pacified the conceptual process in a truly effective way, so that meditative state would be still functioning even in the post-meditative state and would be a part of the bodhisattva's way of perceiving the appearances. The example again being the way you would perceive appearances in a dream if you recognize it's a dream. Whereas for the gods in this equilibrium of cessation, when they wake up out of that meditation, they begin to experience appearances in the same way that was done before they went into that samadhi. You know, so in other words, they fall down into the desire realm, reborn there, and have to go through the whole process again. So there is no lasting effect from that from all of these types of non-conceptual states. They are just a temporary state of non-conceptuality. There is also the case of things which in their composition are non-conceptual. That's the next point. Things in their composition. And that means objects, that is to say forms and so on, the sensory faculties of the eye and so on, which are material and therefore non-conceptual in their very makeup, without there being non-conceptual wisdom because of that. So at this point, Rinpoche knocked on the table, right? So in having a material makeup is non-conceptual. The table can't think. Any object of consciousness is non-conceptual in that way. And the actual faculty of the eye is non-conceptual in the same way. So your eye cannot think the object.
But when you said that everything is mind.
Yeah, but
why now do we replace it?
But we even the Chittamatras differentiate the Dzungwe Cha, right, the perceived aspect of mind, which corresponds
to
the object.
Would you say that the perceived object of mind, perceived aspect of mind, is it what is meant here?
Yeah, I mean, it would be the Chittamatran term Dzungwe Cha, right, perceived aspect of mind, goes with the explanation of relative mind. The relative process of mind, which is the ordinary confused state. Right? And within that confused state, there is a duality of something being perceived, which corresponds to the objects appearing because of the habitual tendencies. And then the perceiving mind, which is able to form a concept about that object. So the conceptual process is carried out by the perceiving mind, not by the perceived object. Right? Even in the Chittamatran explanation. So the objects are not able to think. I mean, if they were, they would be able to... This cup could sort of call out to you and say, hey, I'm a cup.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, I'm talking to this level. Because in the end, this cup doesn't exist. It's just my projection or whatever. It is. If it is the perceived aspect of the mind, it's no different than the mind.
It's not something other than mind, but within that relative mind you can distinguish different processes, right? In the same way that, let's say, the mother and the wife and the mistress, it's not three different women maybe, right? But seeing the woman from different perspectives, right? So perceived aspect of mind and perceiving aspect is the same mind, but it's very different functions. And the perceived aspect of mind has no ability to form concepts. That's the function of the perceiving aspect of mind. I mean, this is not difficult to understand, right? Tables can't think. Even if you think of the table as a projection of your mind, then it is you that is thinking the table, not the table that is thinking that it is being thought about. Right? It's still your mind that is thinking the table. So the table is non-conceptual, even in that explanation, right?
Okay. Let's leave.
One shouldn't drop it until it's clear, right? Even though, I mean, there's a certain limit to how long we can spend on each point. But you can keep coming back to it again and again, and you can maybe ask Rinpoche if there's a chance at some point. And in fact, the way the texts work, very often one finds that things come up in the text that were never really thought about. You know, one didn't think about it at all from that kind of an angle. So it seems very strange the first time you hear it, right? You can't really sort of get the picture I was talking about. And so one needs to sort of study a number of texts and see what's said in different contexts about the same sort of things, and then we'd start to put a bigger picture together.
I mean, right? Ultimately, what would be the difference between the table and me? I mean, this is a question that it's been in my mind, you know,
since beginning this time.
Ultimately, it shouldn't be any different.
No, ultimately there's no difference. That's one of the Chittamatran points, right? But ultimately there's no difference. The fire burning you in the dream appears to be a real fire, so that's what it is. So you can't get out of that dream. Because so in other words, from that point of view, we have to admit that there's a relative aspect of mind and an ultimate, or there's genuine reality and there's apparent reality. So we've already got a device for measuring things in terms of what they are in different contexts. And then within that relative context, we can then say, what are objects? Right? And then you can define it from the Vaibhashika point of view, from the Sautantrika, from Chittamatra and so on. And certainly from the Chittamatra and upwards, the object is not something different than mind. It's nongsem yer me. Appearance and mind inseparable. But even looked at from that point of view, the appearance, we had in fact a statement something like that in one part of the commentary. It's not, the mind is not produced through appearances. Appearances are produced through the mind. That's another way of saying that the appearances are non-conceptual. You know, it's not appearances thinking, oh, there is a mind perceiving me, therefore I must act like a cup. So the object is just the projected aspect of mind. Right?
So this is an distinction, though. This is a dualism.
Yeah, it's a dualism.
Minds that can create objects, concepts, or objects, and objects that cannot create minds.
Yeah, that's the dualism, because we're talking about the relative process of consciousness there, where the dualism applies. Right? And within that context, we have objects, right? We have seeming outer objects, and these objects are non-conceptual in their very makeup. They're not able to think. But that doesn't mean that they are non-conceptual wisdom. You know, if they were, then by merely seeing objects, you would be seeing pure being. And it's an important distinction, because one can get the idea that, you know, seeing things as they are means, well, just open your eyes and ears and you will see reality. Right? You will see pure being, which it becomes a completely different kind of view. So, the next one is called predetermination. And the commentary says, predetermination, whereby one were to think, now I will not form any concept whatsoever, would also not be non-conceptual. Because to engage in predetermination in the sense of explicitly and consciously thinking, I will not form a concept, would itself be a distinctly perceptual act, which itself would involve entertaining attributes or assigning labels, and will therefore not be non-conceptual. So this is where Rinpoche sat right straight up on the throne and said, I am a non-conceptual yogi experiencing non-conceptuality. You know, if that's the way you think when you meditate on the emptiness, right, then that itself is a new concept. Or if you... you know, you consciously formulate for yourself the idea, now I will be non-conceptual. Then it's a new concept.
It's even a wrong concept in the relative layer.
Yes. and of course, in terms of meditation, it would be very difficult to avoid, as we've discovered in trying to do the Pasalika practice. Very difficult to avoid. And this corresponds to what Rinpoche was explaining this morning at about 5, 4:30 or 5 o'clock, whenever it was. Seemed like, anyway. When he was talking about if you have, if you think this is emptiness, or this appearance is empty of any conceptual, any substantial essence, and is therefore just empty, like empty space, then that is thinking of the thing as being a non-thing, and applying the thought of emptiness, and then you have a focal referent for a thinking mind. So you have still duality, in fact, perceived object and perceiver. It's just that the perceived object is the idea of emptiness. And that's the same sort of thing that's going on here. Right? Mm-hmm. Down here, you have the thought of being non-conceptual, and up here you have the mind that is thinking that. Right? Mm-hmm. I will be non-conceptual. Right? So you have two things in relation to each other. There's a reference point for the meditation, and therefore it's not non-conceptual wisdom. Non-conceptual wisdom would be to realize the freedom from conceptual elaborations of the thinking mind itself and rest within that true Tao Jing Nang. Then there's no reference point. Then it's true non-conceptual wisdom. And this act of predetermination and can rest within mind itself. So, so these are the five areas whose nature is such that the term non-conceptual is applied, the unqualified exclusion of which reveals the concrete characteristic of non-conceptual original wisdom. And here we have this curious term, concrete characteristic, rongxin. And in the Sautrantaka system, that would refer to the immediate appearance of the characteristics of an object to the perceiving mind. So in other words, at that level of at the Hinayana level of explanation, concrete characteristics of the object are the like the flower appearing in your garden, where you can see that it's red and it has such and such a shape and so on. So that in the Hinayana, in the Sautrantaka system, that is defined as genuine reality. The concrete characteristic of a thing is its genuine reality. That is what is really there. And we're using that term in the same sort of way here. We're saying the concrete characteristic of non-conceptual original wisdom, what it really is the exclusion of these five. So when you eliminate everything that it is not, you get down to what it actually is. So even though it's not concrete characteristic in a dualistic sense of something you can see or hear or so on, nevertheless, since that's what it really is, that is concrete characteristic. Hence, non-conceptual original wisdom itself should be understood to be that which does... Now we're going to say what it is, actually. He's giving us more than he promised. He only promised to say what it's not, and now he's going to say what it is. Hence, non-conceptual original wisdom itself should be understood to be that which does not conceptualize any theoretical conclusion nor any aspect of conceptual elaborations whatsoever, and, in addition, now comes the what it is. It is the light of wisdom accompanying intimate self-awareness, which manifests from within, and is free of the distorting filter of doubt regarding the non-referential reality of fundamental being. He warned us, so we probably wouldn't know what that was. But
without reference,
there's no duality. You don't have something.
Reality without duality.
Without duality, yeah. There's not a split into something being perceived and a perceiver, so there's no relative process of consciousness. And that also is implied by saying it manifests from within, not in connection with this outside dualistic way of perceiving things, but it's coming from within one's own being. And one's own being is, or what appears there, what appears, how do we say? What is non-conceptual reason and wisdom when that appears in a way that can be experienced? Then it is Soso Rang Rigpe Yeshe, which is translated here intimate self-awareness. And as we heard earlier, the term self-awareness means no duality. There's no difference between what one is being aware of and the one who is aware. They're not two. And that is in a way which is free of doubts. And the doubts would function as if there were doubts, then it functions like this eye sickness, where there seems to be hairs falling down in front of your eyes, where there are no hairs. So that would cloud your vision. It would, you'd be seeing things through this filter of hairs. When there are no... Well, there are many different kind of doubts. From within, from inside, in a way that involves no focal referent. And this is what is meant by fundamental mind, or fundamental being. And it is also what is meant by non-conceptual original wisdom. If we could go into some distinctions there, but Rinpoche did not go into them, and I think at this point it would be too confusing. So we'll leave it at that. So in other words, we're equating pure being and non-conceptual wisdom at this point. So if you ask what is non-conceptual original wisdom, then it is this. The light of wisdom accompanying intimate self-awareness, which manifests from within and is free of the distorting filter of doubt regarding the non-referential reality of fundamental being. So since that is so difficult to understand what that is, then one can think about it in terms of these five cases of what it is not. And if you eliminate those five, then what you will have left, you don't have to have any doubts about. That's the way Rinpoche ended that section. Then we go on to the next verse. So the third point here is completely understanding its marks involves its being free of conceptualization as such, the fact that it is not transitional, it's not remaining while being perennial, its hallmark of being completely unexcelled, which constitute its five distinctive marks. And this term distinctive marks, we've had it in several forms as we've gone along, and it always has had the connotation of what are the specific traits that makes the Mahayana realization particularly elevated in comparison with the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha. And that is to say, in this context, that the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddhas actually achieve non-conceptual wisdom, but it's different. There are some distinctive marks of the Mahayana non-conceptual wisdom which make it superior to what they achieve. And that's what we're going to have explained here. So there are five different marks that make it different. Completely understanding its marks of special distinction involves understanding the fact of its being free of the conceptualization as such of a rejection of samsara and an adoption of nirvana. The fact that it is not a transitional relinquishment and realization, but the full completion of these. It's not remaining fixed in either extreme of conditioned existence or pacification, while being perennial in its persistence in samsaric existence for the sake of others by virtue of the Dharmakaya, which is permanent in essence. Its hallmark of being unsurpassed, supreme over all, in that it is completely unexcelled by anything else, which constitute the five distinctive marks of its superiority over the listeners and self-Buddhas, since they, in conceptualizing a samsara nirvana and so on, fall short of these special features. So this one is not so difficult to follow, it seems. At least most of it. The main point is that the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas are, in connection with the first of these, they still have a very literal sense that there are certain that samsara is something that has to be eliminated. So it constitutes a kind of garbage, you know, sort of kind of a piece of garbage that you have to throw out into some kind of a garbage can or somewhere, throw it over the neighbor's wall or wherever you throw it. And maybe recycle it. You throw it in the Green Point bag and recycle it. That's why it's called samsara. The recycle of existence. And then where you then land is in nirvana, which is this nice garbage-free state. So that's a very dualistic idea of it, where there's something to be rejected and something to be adopted in a very conceptual kind of literal way. And since that's the way they relate to it, it's not... it doesn't correspond with the way it really is. Whereas the Bodhisattvas and the Buddhas see the inseparability of samsara and nirvana, that the one is not something that you can get rid of as if it was an outer factor of some kind. And then having got rid of that, you then realize something other. Rinpoche didn't go into very much detail about this, but the main point is that non-conceptual wisdom, from the point of view of non-conceptual wisdom, there is no dichotomy. There's samsara and nirvana are seen as inseparable. So that means the bodhisattvas are not conceptualizing a samsara that is to be rejected and a nirvana to be adopted as if they were two separate factors. Then the second reason why the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas' non-conceptual wisdom is greater than that of the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas is that they do not have a merely transitional form of relinquishment and realization, but the completely perfect form of these. So a transitional relinquishment would mean one that only lasts up to a certain point and then is no longer valid. And the same with the realization. At least have to give up the idea that they had of nirvana. And then that becomes maybe a little bit more clear in the next point, that there is no staying, literally, nepame. Rinpoche said before we go on that this point of its being transitional means that it's not ultimate. They haven't gotten to the end yet. They haven't gotten to the ultimate relinquishment and realization. And because it's not the end yet, then they have to go on from where they're at and get to the end. And then the next thing that they don't have is it's not remaining. And what this means is that the type of realization that the bodhisattvas do not remain either in conditioned existence or in pacification, whereas the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha arhats, even though they do not remain in samsaric existence, they do remain, they get stuck in pacification, in nirvana. They run down. Their batteries run down, or they get stuck there. Whereas the bodhisattvas, through their prajna, through their superior knowledge, they do not get stuck in samsaric existence, and through their compassion and loving kindness, they do not get stuck in nirvana. So they have a non-remaining type of nirvana, and this could be translated in various ways, but here it's been translated literally given the context. So it's not remaining fixed in either extreme of conditioned existence or pacification, while being perennial. And these two points seem to contradict each other. It doesn't remain, but it's perennial. Perennial means more or less that it's permanent, that it's eternal. That it is always changeless. And this seems to contradict what we have heard before, right? We've been taught there is nothing permanent. Now we've been told that the non-conceptual wisdom of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is something permanent. So either we have to all jump off the stupa, or we have to understand what's going on. So it would probably be nicer to do the latter. So what it means is, while being perennial in its persistence in samsaric existence for the sake of others by virtue of the Dharmakaya, which is permanent in essence. So Rinpoche said, this sense of permanence is not in a relative sense, but in an ultimate sense. In a relative sense, one would be talking about phenomena. And the permanent existence of phenomena, which would mean that any appearance, like a form, sound, smell, taste, touch, or thought, would be the same in the second instant as it was in the first. And because it didn't change between the first and the second, then it would carry on in that same way. And that is not the kind of... I mean, the permanence that is being talked about is not that sort of dualistic idea of permanence. It is a permanence in the sense of genuine reality, a type of permanence which transcends being permanent or not permanent. That is to say, transcends any concept about permanence. You know, it transcends the conceptual approach to permanence. Yes. Yeah, it means something like stable. I have a note here from previous explanation, where he called his explanation of tendu was taktu yurpa. Taktu jurva me. Taktu jurva me. Yeah, taktu jurva me rong yin. So it is something always unchanging. Something that always exists in an unchanging way, or always stays in an unchanged form. And the thing that does this is the Dharmakaya. And we're talking about, by its very essence, it is permanent. How can we say, in its very nature, it is permanent? Since within Dharmakaya there is neither the concept of things as being composite, nor the concept of there being non-composite, it transcends anything that could change. And therefore is permanent. Yesterday we heard the same sort of explanation from the point of view of bliss. That one of the benefits of non-conceptual wisdom is that one achieves unchanging bliss. Bliss that doesn't leak. And that's the kind of bliss that goes with unchanging Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya is the unleaking bucket for that unleaking bliss, if you want to put it that way. And then the next point is its hallmark of being unsurpassed, supreme over all, in that it is completely unexcelled by anything else. So that just means there's nothing higher. The terms in the Tibetan kongna and lana mepa, kongna mepa and lana mepa are exact synonyms. Kong and la, kong and la are exact synonyms, they have the same meaning. They just mean the top. And mepa means there's nothing above that top, there's nothing over it. So it's unsurpassed. And of course here we're talking about the level of Buddhahood at this point. So these constitute the five distinctive marks of its superiority over the non-conceptual wisdom achieved by listeners and self-Buddhas, since they, in conceptualizing a saṃsāra nirvāṇa and so on, fall short of these special features. So they don't pass the examination on any of these five points. They don't get it. But Rinpoche ended by saying, we get it. The Bodhisattva path gives us exactly these five special marks. So now we can sing it through in English.
Yeah.